Today is Tuesday, July 10th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, amid protests outside the U.S. Supreme Court, President Trump announces his nomination to the nation's highest court. The latest on the grueling effort to rescue four remaining boys and their coach from deep inside a waterlogged cave.
This is a couple orders of magnitude more difficult rescue than I think anything has ever been attempted before.
Also ahead, an environmental investigative group finding China companies have been illegally banned substances. It's all on today's International Edition. In what is likely to be one of the most consequential decisions of his presidency, Donald Trump has selected Federal Appeals Court Judge Brett Kavanaugh as his nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy.
What matters is not a judge's political views, but whether they can set aside those views to do what the law and the Constitution require. I am pleased to say that I have found, without doubt, such a person.
Well, the 53-year-old Kavanaugh is known as a devout Catholic whose position on one of America's most politically charged issues, abortion, has raised concern on both sides. Joining us now is Nick Dahm, Los Angeles-based appellate and constitutional attorney with Kendall Brill and Kelly. What can you tell us about this nominee?
He is about as well-credentialed a conservative justice as you could possibly imagine. He clerked for Justice Kennedy. Then after that, he worked first in a solicitor general's office and then for Ken Starr when Ken Starr was investigating Bill Clinton. He then worked in the White House very closely with former President Bush. He was nominated for the D.C. Circuit, which is effectively the second most important court in the country after the United States Supreme Court. He has been a reliably very conservative, by all accounts very smart, but very conservative voice on the D.C. Circuit.
Judge Kavanaugh apparently had a previous ruling about the ability to indict a president. We know the president is concerned about the Mueller investigation. Is there any indication that the president had an agenda when he made this decision as far as those types of rulings and his own concerns about the ability to indict a president?
One of the interesting things about Judge Kavanaugh is that this is an issue on which he's been surprisingly clear, not so much in a judicial ruling, but he actually has a published law review article, and I believe the Minnesota Law Review, in which he says that it's his belief that a sitting president should not be subject to criminal indictment, or for that matter, civil indictment. The current law is that a president can be civilly charged in a civil suit for things that he did before he became president, and Judge Kavanaugh said it's his belief that, at least as a matter of policy, that should not be the case. So he's very clearly on record for that. But I should say that most serious constitutional scholars think that you can't indict a sitting president, that the federal government cannot have a criminal indictment of a president while that president is in office. And why is that? Because the Constitution provides a specific remedy for crimes that a president commits while in office. That remedy is impeachment. So the Congress, not the courts, ultimately sit as the trier of a crime by the president. And so that's why the Constitution doesn't resolve this in language one way or another, and the Supreme Court has never resolved it. But I think it's safe to say that the mainstream view of most people who think seriously about these issues is that it's the job of Congress through the impeachment process to take care of crimes that a president commits while in office. So in terms of what does this mean for the Mueller investigation, the special counsel's inquiry, the result of that inquiry is going to be a report. That report will then go to Congress. Congress will have the ultimate decision as to whether or not to pursue impeachment. So I think it's fairly unlikely that in any event that Judge Kavanaugh could be some sort of get-out-of-jail-free card for the president, or that there was some kind of nefarious deal struck between the president and Judge Kavanaugh on this issue. I just think that's extraordinarily unlikely and probably not consistent with what Judge Kavanaugh would do given what we know about him.
And the big issue that everybody's been really focused on, and what lawmakers who are going going to be tasked with interviewing Judge Kavanaugh and voting on his nomination. Some people are saying it's all but likely that abortion rights in the U.S. will be overturned or dramatically limited. Is that what you see as likely?
So there's not a huge track record on this particular issue to draw from with Judge Kavanaugh, so we can't say with any certainty. I personally believe that it is overwhelmingly likely that abortion rights will be quite seriously limited from the place that they are now. It's also worth noting that a lot of people don't really realize this. While Roe v. Wade is on the books, the Supreme Court has permitted really quite serious restrictions on the rights to obtain abortion, to the point that in many states there are maybe one abortion clinic operating in the entire state. I think that it is extraordinarily likely that Judge Kavanaugh would vote to uphold those kinds of restrictions and maybe more serious restrictions. Whether or not he'll actually take the step of overturning Roe v. Wade, I don't think anybody knows the answer to that question except maybe him. So it's hard to come down with a definitive answer on that. But if I had to guess, I would say that it is more likely than not that he does. The Roe decision, of course, has been the target of conservative ire for decades now, and that absolutely includes people in the same judicial circles that Judge Kavanaugh has participated in. So if I had to bet, I would bet that it's more likely than not that Roe is overturned. I would bet that it's almost certain that abortion rights are more severely restricted than they are now, but this isn't really something that we can know at this point.
Is there any indication that he could have some trouble getting through the nomination
process?
Well,
I'm not an expert on Congress. I've seen reports that say Mitch McConnell actually recommended against nominating Judge Kavanaugh precisely because Judge Kavanaugh has this very extensive record, published articles, many decisions from his time on the D.C. Circuit. There's a lot of material there, and I'm sure people in Congress who were opposed to Judge Kavanaugh will be combing over that material quite intensely, looking for things to use in the confirmation process. At the end of the day, it's a majority vote, and the Senate has a majority of Republicans, so I think you would have to think that the odds are overwhelmingly likely that Judge Kavanaugh would be confirmed.
All right. That's Los Angeles-based constitutional attorney Nick Dom. Thank you for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The U.S. and Vietnam will cooperate on freedom of navigation in the disputed South China Sea. The U.S. says it will release and reunite 50 immigrant children. The U.S. disputes a report that it opposed breastfeeding. And the Pope will head to Panama for World Youth Day. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Thai authorities say four more boys have arrived safely at the hospital following their rescue after having been trapped in a flooded cave for more than 2 weeks. A total of eight boys have now been rescued over the past 2 days. The head of the Thai rescue operation has asked for three more days to rescue the remaining four boys and their coach. 13 international divers and 5 Thai Navy SEALs are involved in the operation to rescue the boys and their coach, who've been stranded about 4 kilometers inside the cave. Joining us now to talk more about this astounding rescue effort is cave expert Gary Schindel, president of the National Speleological Society. Gary, this certainly appears to have been a masterpiece of planning.
I understand they have over 3,000 people working on the project. It seems to be very well organized. They are basically doing multiple projects there concurrently. They're evaluating the possibility of drilling. They were evaluating, trying to find new entrances. The cave divers were able to push through extremely difficult diving conditions to find the kids.
So I understand there are literally 2 divers per boy that they're escorting out?
That's my understanding, correct. You have a cave dive that probably would not have been pushed except for the conditions, the fact that they were trying to find the kids, because there are so many technical issues with cave diving. If you can imagine, it's probably like diving in chocolate milk. There's no visibility, even difficult to read your gauges. There's currents you have to deal with. There's overhead constriction, so you can't just come up if you run out of air. You have to use a guideline, and so that way you can find your way in and out with no visibility. So it's extremely difficult diving. There are not that many people who are trained to do, have the training and the experience to do this kind of diving. The cave divers that they brought in from Britain are some of the best in the world. They're well known internationally, and they've done this kind of work and were successful. Quite impressive.
Sounds pretty harrowing to be diving in water you can't see at all. How are there currents in sitting water in a cave?
Well, there's actually water rushing in. We're at the beginning of the monsoon season. The kids went in to the cave, which was dry at the time. They crawled through a fairly easy cave, and probably they're familiar with it. They've probably been back there before. And then, of course, the rains came. Very heavy rains flooded the low spots and basically trapped them. And part of the complicating issue with this is bringing them out is now you have a number of young kids, which equipment isn't really designed for. They have, some of them may not even be able to swim. You've got to get them comfortable with basically putting their face under the water, breathing through a mask, and then maybe doing that for about a half mile through some places where the constrictions, the divers had to take off their gear and push it through. And as the passages narrow, the currents usually increase. And so there's probably some serious issues in there for the divers. If you can imagine just trying to orient yourself by not being able to feel anything, all you can do is feel the tug and pull of the currents themselves in the caves.
And my understanding is that they brought out some of the boys that were feeling the strongest and healthiest out first. But if conditions are potentially getting worse, and I understand the coach is probably doing the least well, why would they have made the choice to take the strongest boys first?
I think that they probably felt that if there was a problem with the strongest kids, the youngest kids, they probably wouldn't have exposed to the dive. If they can bring the strongest kids out, it does a couple things. One is it gives the divers some experience in dealing with people who have never dove before. Then the second thing is if that they've experienced problems in there with the kids that are really healthy, then they wouldn't even try, you know, bringing out the kids who were less healthy in that. So I think it was probably the right decision.
What kind of extra precautions or measures would they have to take for, say, the coach if this person is actually very weak?
That's a good question. A lot of it depends on what, you know, what their physical conditions are, if they've got any medical issues and that. So it would be really hard to speculate on what additional things they may have to do to be able to bring out kids that may be a little weaker. They may have felt that giving them an extra day of food and rest and that may have actually been better for them.
How long is each rescue in and of itself taking, or would it take?
Well, I assume that there are probably limitations with staging of air bottles. The claim was that they're running low on air or oxygen. In reality, you know, there are certain rules about cave diving. For example, they use what's called the rule of thirds. That is, you go in with a third of your air, you come out with a third of your air, and you use a third of your air for any emergency or other issues that you have to deal with. Things like line entanglement. You know, you can get your diving gear caught up in the line and you can't move, and you've got to sit there and basically work that out in the dark with no visibility in that. So it takes an incredibly cool head to do this. So there are lots of issues that could occur there. You know, with diving, I'm sure they're trying to work through them, trying to stage air bottles in the event that they run low because some of the kids may have problems getting through some areas or panicking or whatever. So staging the proper equipment and getting all of the people in place. My understanding, there's a big mound of mud that you have to crawl up over and then back down. You can imagine doing that with, you know, close to 100 pounds of gear on for these cave divers. It is not an easy task. The problem with the folks who are managing the thing is that there were no good answers. All of the decisions and all that they had to make are all ones that if you had another option, you wouldn't do. I mean, bringing inexperienced kids out on a long cave dive like that is very dangerous. It looks to me like they've spent a great deal of time setting it up and planning it and trying to make sure that there's a positive outcome. So it speaks very well to the management of the rescue. This is a couple orders of magnitude more difficult rescue than I think anything has ever been attempted before.
All right, that's cave expert Gary Schindel. Thank you for your expertise. Well, British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson resigned Monday amid disagreement in the cabinet over the nation's exit from the European Union. Johnson's departure comes a day after Britain's Brexit minister David Davis stepped down from his post following a contentious meeting between ministers on Britain's strategy to exit the EU. Davis and Johnson were among cabinet members who advocated for a clean break, while others support a so-called soft Brexit that would retain economic ties with the bloc. Joining us now to discuss is London-based journalist Amy Gutman. Thanks for being with us. What's the significance of these resignations?
Neither of these were a surprise, particularly the departure of Boris Johnson. That has always been a tense relationship. Boris Johnson is known for mouthing off, for making highly inappropriate comments, for sticking his foot in his mouth, and for battling Theresa May specifically over Brexit. And in fact, when she came out over the weekend, after she had finalized her proposal and gotten consensus on her Brexit proposal, she specifically said, anyone who does not agree with this proposal in my cabinet can leave. It was very much a either with us or against us declaration. And that was to say, I will not have dissent in my cabinet because this has been agreed. That's why they were at the prime minister's country residence checkers last week. They painfully acquired a consensus about it to take it to Brussels, to the EU. And so her feeling is, look, we all have to get behind this. And unless you have a better plan, which no one has seemed to, this is what we're going with. Now, the reason why Boris Johnson and David Davis have left is because both of these gentlemen were leading, as they say here, Brexiteers. That means they were both leading the campaign for Brexit all along. In fact, Boris Johnson, who is a real political animal, he really burned a lot of bridges, specifically with David Cameron, over his strong belief that Brexit was the only way to go. So Boris Johnson and David Davis both believe that the deal that Theresa May has agreed that she is going to present to the EU is simply too much of a straddling between the EU and the UK. It all has to do with the customs union. It's all down to trade, and they very much feel like, look, Brexit is about hard decisions. Brexit was never going to be easy. That's why there's a two-year transition period. We got to take the good with the bad. And they feel that she's given too much away, that she's trying to negotiate. I don't even want to say too hard, but that she's trying to negotiate too much with the EU and be too conciliatory. So that's what these moves were all about. They also will be interested in trying to shake up and unsettle her position and the perception of her as a strong leader. But she has already replaced both of these roles. So I'm sure she had their replacements in mind days ago.
But does this put her position in jeopardy at all as far as her leadership ability? Is her government in jeopardy?
Prime Minister Theresa May's government is not in jeopardy in that in the UK, it's the party who's elected, not the person. So the Conservatives are in power. They will remain in power until the next election. That is certain. The party can decide internally to change the leader, which would then change the prime minister, who the prime minister is. This is no time to do that. That will not happen before Brexit. It's simply too unsettling. It would send the value of the sterling into the ground. As it is, when Boris Johnson quit today, we saw the value of the sterling against the dollar drop a bit, not overly, but it did drop a bit. So it would simply be too unsettling to change leadership at this point. But certainly these resignations will unsettle the perception of her leadership a little bit. But it's also rumored that the EU, who would normally be going very hard on Theresa May, and they really have been very tough on her, especially given that they know she has people to please on this side of the continent, it's believed that they're actually going to go very soft on her for the moment, because the last thing they want to do is see her leave power. They feel like she is finally coming to the table. They feel like they have a negotiating partner in Theresa May. They do not want to see that leadership change. So for now, the EU is not going to go too hard. They're going to go softly, softly until October, till things are agreed, to ensure that they do nothing to damage or deteriorate Theresa May's position.
What about President Trump? He's planning on seeing her when he's there for the NATO summit.
He will see her for the NATO summit, yes. It's unclear what will come out of that at this time in terms of UK-US alliances.
All right. Well, we appreciate your perspective. That's London-based journalist Amy Gutman. Thanks for being with us. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Sporty greetings to all our VOA listeners. This is Sonny Young, host of The Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC, Monday through Friday, for special World Cup updates during the month-long football festival in Russia. Right here on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Nikki Strong. You love music? How about Blake Shelton and Carrie Underwood? Or Merle Haggard and Loretta Lynn? Experience the best in country music on Country Hits USA. I bring you some country rock, outlaw, a little hillbilly, contemporary, and more, with a dash of entertainment news, too. So join me for Country Hits USA on VOA 1, the voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Well, since the 1800s, scientists have marveled at how spiders can take flight using their webbing. Sadie Witkowski reports on new research that shows spiders are getting an aerial boost from the Earth's electrostatic field.
Worldwide thunderstorms help generate an electric field around the Earth. This shifting electric field can be sensed by some bee species, but scientists Erica Morley and Daniel Robert from the University of Bristol wanted to test if spiders might sense and use this electrostatic field to fly. There were some prior observations to support this idea, says biologist Kimberly Sheldon from the University of Tennessee, Knoxville.
So these spiders will have, you know, 5 or 6 drag lines, and those drag lines, those strands of silk, do not get entangled. And so we've known for a while that electrostatics were probably at least interacting with the spider, the silk lines themselves, to keep them from getting tangled.
To test their idea about electric fields in flight, Morley and Robert created a box with a grounded metal plate on the bottom and a plate above that they could pass an electrical current through. They placed spiders in the box and turned on the voltage, watching as the creatures reacted to the electric field. Lead researcher Morley describes what they saw.
So we filmed the spiders and their response to an electric field and saw that when you switch the field on, they start to perform this behavior called tiptoeing.
Spiders only tiptoe right before they release their silk drag lines to fly away, in a process called ballooning. When the spiders did balloon and rise into the air, turning off the electric current caused them to drop. Clearly, the spiders were able to sense the local electrostatic field and respond appropriately by releasing silk. But Morley wanted to know how.
As a sensory biologist, I was keen to understand what sensory system they might use to detect electric fields. And we know that they have very sensitive hairs that are displaced or moved by air movements and even sound. So I thought that it's possible that they might be using these same hairs to detect electric fields.
This was exactly what she observed. The small hairs along the spider's legs react not only to physical experiences like a breeze, but also to the electric field. Spiders probably use both when choosing the right time to take off. Mathematician Longhua Zhao from Case Western Preserve has made computer models of how spiders balloon.
I think both electric field and the fluid mechanics are important. They definitely play very important role. However, we don't know at this point which is the dominant effect.
The University of Bristol study is the first experiment ever to test how spiders use electrostatic fields. Sadie Witkowski, VOA News, Washington.
Well, for decades, Jim Henson's Muppets have captured the imagination of children and adults worldwide. A traveling exhibit at the Skirball Cultural Center in Los Angeles not only showcases some of the most beloved Muppets, but also the work that took place behind the scenes to entertain as well as educate. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has more.
Kermit the Frog and Miss Piggy, familiar faces beloved by generations of adults and children around the world. Just two of many well-known Muppets created by Jim Henson and featured in this traveling exhibit.
If you learn from Sesame Street, he teaches you how to count. There's Cookie Monster. He does the ABCs every episode.
We're excited for people to understand that he was a very multifaceted artist, a very adventurous, creative mind.
Jim Henson's eldest daughter, Lisa, heads Los Angeles-based The Jim Henson Company and describes her father, who died in 1990, as a technology geek.
As family members, we were always quite included in the productions. He was encouraging us to be with him on set all the time. He would love to tell us how the best techniques of puppet building were the new innovations that they would make in terms of mechanics or electronics, and how he was advancing the technology.
The universal appeal of Henson's work launched shows such as Sesame Street, The Muppet Show, and Fraggle Rock onto the international stage.
Hi, Bobo. Hi, Wimberly.
Hi.
你们要听我的诗吗?
Here's an episode in Mandarin.
你可问你的诗吗?
And in Spanish.
Lo hacemos, Rosy, lo prometo.
He was trying to think of how to make his work kind of connect with people and resonate with people internationally. It's a responsibility to be positive and to promote good values like acceptance, tolerance, promoting individualism and diversity. And he started to feel that responsibility more because his work was getting so popular.
Museum goers will not only see the beloved puppets from shows such as Sesame Street and The Muppet Show, they also see what it takes to bring these characters to life.
You can see original sketches, actually notes of the very beginnings of ideas, all the way through to finished puppets.
Maybe we could co-star.
The exhibit is a creative archaeological experience that shows Henson's work from the 1950s to 1990. Although computer-generated imagery may have replaced some puppets in Hollywood, Lisa Henson says the art of puppetry is alive and well today.
It gives it a kind of immediacy in performance and intimacy that people connect to that, and they kind of feel like that, you know, the puppets are a little more alive. And so I don't think puppets will ever go entirely out of style.
The Muppets and new puppets can continue to entertain and educate for generations to come. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show. Thanks for joining us. Find us anytime at voanews.com. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Venezuelan economy is in free fall with soaring inflation and severe shortages of food, water, and medicine. Political opponents of the regime of Nicolas Maduro reportedly have been subjected to imprisonment and torture. Faced with such misery, hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans have fled their homeland. On a recent visit to Brazil, Vice President Mike Pence noted that Venezuela, once one of the wealthiest countries in the region, is now essentially a failed state. Venezuela's collapse is creating a humanitarian crisis, leading to widespread deprivations, the denial of basic services, and starvation, and it spurred the largest cross-border mass exodus in the history of our hemisphere, Mr. Pence said. To help meet this crisis, the vice president announced nearly $10 million in additional humanitarian U.S. assistance for Venezuelans who have fled their country. More than $1 million will go directly to support relief operations in Brazil. Over 50,000 Venezuelans have arrived in northern Brazil since 2017. The additional $10 million brings the total U.S. humanitarian assistance to nearly $31 million since 2017. The newly announced funds include a contribution to the International Organization for Migration's regional response to the Venezuela crisis, support for the UN World Food Program's emergency response efforts for Venezuelans who have recently arrived in Ecuador, and other humanitarian aid to Venezuelans and host communities in Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, and Brazil. Complementing this assistance, the U.S. State Department said in a written statement, is $18.5 million in bilateral funding to support displaced Venezuelans in Colombia who have fled the crisis. The State Department praised the generosity of countries throughout the hemisphere who are hosting Venezuelans escaping the crisis at home and urged additional contributions by all donors to meet their growing humanitarian needs. The State Department also urged countries to increase their support for the restoration of Venezuela's democracy. Vice President Pence noted that as long as Maduro denies democracy and basic rights to his people, Venezuela will continue to crumble. The United States will not stand idly by as Venezuela crumbles, he said. Venezuela deserves better, and the Venezuelan people deserve to reclaim their birthright of libertad.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.